He was a millionaire farmer that fed prostitutes to pigs. He got away with it for almost 2 decades. He bragged about it to an undercover cop, about slaughtering 49 women, and was eventually sent to prison. Although, he was only convicted of 6 counts of second-degree murder, he's the most disturbingly vile serial killer in Canadian history, and his name is Robert Willie Picton. Today I'm going to run through his environment, his early life, his family life, his profession, his killing spree, and how he was eventually brought to justice. Just want to quickly say apologies for my tardiness. I was supposed to put this episode out on Halloween night. I had this plan for a few weeks, like I was going to put this episode out as like a horror story Halloween special, you know yourself, like, and I just couldn't do it. My voice was failing me for the last few weeks, and only now is it starting to make a return. So here we are. Bear with me because my voice is not all the way there yet. But I also have to say, look, if you haven't heard my 3-part podcast about Vancouver's downtown east side, I strongly urge you to go back and listen to those 3 episodes before you hear today's episode. I did those 3 episodes about 6 months ago now, I believe, episode 20, 21 and 22. So, yeah, the area is very relevant to today's horror story, so it'd be better for you just to have a bit of background knowledge about the whole setting before we get into this story about Willie Picton's pig farm. If you've heard them already, all well and good, but for those who simply don't care enough to go back and listen, let me just give you a quick crash course. Basically, it's the poorest, most dangerous ghetto in North America. It's an urban wasteland where all of Canada's homeless folks, drug addicts, and mentally ill patients, they all congregate in this area called Main and Hastings, or better known as Payne and Wastings. I worked in the heart of it for about a year, and honestly, you do witness some really traumatizing things, like rat infestations, drug overdoses, open drug use, open prostitution, stabbings, and you know, all sorts of violence. Rubbish, needles, used condoms all over the footpath. It's basically Canada's Skid Row and home to about 5,000 to 10,000 residents at any given time. And you know, these people, they take up the whole sidewalk on both sides of the street. The street is dominated with fentanyl-laced heroin and crack cocaine. The block is mostly controlled by Hell's Angels biker gang or Asian mobs, mostly the Vietnamese mob as far as I know. And most of the people that live on the street are indigenous Native Americans who, you know, it's well documented that they were treated terribly at the hands of the Canadian government. But of course, not all homeless folks are drug addicts, and not all drug addicts are homeless. But in this area, it's safe to assume that each individual is either one or the other, or both. Most of Maine and Hastings' female drug addicts, they support their habits by working as a prostitute. Their skeletal bodies walk the streets night and day looking for desperate men that'll pay for their next fix, their next meal, place to stay, whatever. It's this kind of desperation that can leave these women vulnerable and open to robberies, beatings, kidnapping, or forced confinement. You know, you're a prostitute, you're getting into a car with a strange man, you don't know what he really wants, and you don't know what he's capable of. It's a dangerous game. And one thing you've got to keep in mind is that these women are complete community outcasts. Like, they might have no family, no friends, no obligation to anyone, no purpose in life, no record of them even having a life. It's very sad and it's very scary, but what I'm saying to you is, like, you could kill one or tie one up in your basement for years and nobody's going to miss them. Nobody's even going to be looking for them. or even notice that they've gone missing. You know, if a girl goes missing, it's like, meh. Police just kind of shrug their shoulders, like, so what? It's not a big deal. The assumptions made are endless. Like, maybe she took a drug overdose and died. Maybe she got a ticket out of Vancouver and just up and left. Maybe she checked into rehab or checked into the hospital, or maybe she even fell in love and ran away with her new partner. From the police point of view, these women are choosing to live a high-risk life as it is. So if one, two, three, or even four women go missing, it's like, oh well, they're not going to waste any resources looking for them. Pardon me. See what I mean about my voice? Yeah. And another thing that you got to keep in mind as well is, like, a lot of these women don't want to be found. Many of them have spent their whole life on the run. They change their name, and in some cases they probably change their appearance, or they change their address every few months. And, like, considering the size of BC, like, mountains, forests, lakes, and landscapes as far as the eye can see, one missing woman is really like looking for a needle in a haystack if you have no leads whatsoever. Many of these women begin as adolescent runaways and never lose the habit of evasion. Some of them start out as sex workers as young as 11. Like I say, they change their name and addresses so often that investigators have no realistic hope of finding them. Nobody can say with any certainty whether they have disappeared by choice or through foul play. And too often, nobody cares, you know. To this day, men and women go missing all the time in the downtown east side. But during the 80s and 90s, a noticeable trend of prostitutes going missing became apparent. Some were reported missing immediately, and others weren't reported for years. But who's responsible for all this, and how did they get away with it for so long? His name is Robert Willie Picton, also known as the Butcher or the Pig Farmer, Canada's most notorious serial killer ever. So you have a little bit of background about the environment, the victims, and their circumstances. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about Picton himself and his early life and the things that led him to becoming so deranged. And then we'll get into some of the gory stuff, and I'll discuss how they eventually put a stop to his wicked killing spree. Now before we deep dive into the nitty gritty, I just want to say, lads, this one really does hit home for me. It's one thing talking about like a Ted Bundy or a Jack the Ripper and analysing those kind of cases, but this one literally happened in a place that I lived for 3 years, and I've worked on that skid row for 1 year, you know. I used to walk the same street where he picked up prostitutes every day. I've spoken to people who knew the actual killer. I used to go for pints in the killer's local. I've spoken to nieces and nephews of his unfortunate victims, and I used to walk, like I said, that exact street every day where he would pick up his prey. I've witnessed the misery and the disturbing nature of the street. And, you know, oh man, it just makes me feel sick that Picton saw what I saw, but instead of feeling sorry for the people, he found a way to exploit them and use them to satisfy his murderous desires. I always knew that I'd talk about this pig farmer at some point, so I thought, why not this weekend for Halloween? Because, lads, this is really the stuff of nightmares. Obviously, I didn't get to do it on Halloween night, so here we are. And, like, not only that, it's not just a disturbing case in Canada. This is one of the most disturbing cases in the history of mankind. He's one of the worst serial killers in the world ever. Definitely in the top 10, anyway. You know, he's up there with, like, the Chainsaw Massacre, the fucking... the guy that I did last year, the Chikatilo dude, this guy's the worst of the worst, like. And the whole trial, the aftermath, the twists and turns, it's a bizarre case, so definitely do stay tuned right until the end. And with that, let's get into it. Robert Willie Picton was born in Port Coquitlam in 1949. His parents were Louise and Leonard. And a little bit of background about them, you know, your parents play a big role in your upbringing. So Leonard was just a lazy fucktard, basically, that didn't do a tap. You know, he'd sit around and just give orders, but he wouldn't do any work himself, and he didn't do any tidying up. He was just, he didn't have any relationship with the kids, didn't play with them, didn't entertain them whatsoever. Louise, the mother, was a workaholic who was kind of scary, you know, like people have said that her appearance was like, she kind of lost her hair, she kind of grew a beard. She had a high-pitched voice, like, she can't talk like this, you know, like, that's kind of scary, like, you know. And she ran this pig farm every day of her life, basically. And as soon as she had two sons, she got them involved and worked them to the bone. So, yeah, it was a pigsty, literally. The pig farm was nasty. They owned about 700 pigs, and the pigs were allowed in and out of the house, like, no problem. They'd piss and shit all over the house, and it was literally never cleaned. Like, never, ever, ever cleaned. The house was like a hoarder's house now. And even the kids were never cleaned, never showered, and they smelled absolutely horrendous. The brothers, Robert, of course, and his brother, David, they worked on the farm before school and after school, and they absolutely stank. And because they stank so bad, this led to them being bullied and abused in school. They used to call Robert Stinky Piggy. And like, the farm, it was a wealthy enough area, you know, to have a farm. Like, their neighbors were all in big houses, they were all rich doctors. So Willie and David, they were in school with the rich kids, like the doctors' sons and daughters, you know. So obviously they didn't really fit in too well. And when Robert was 11 years old, he went to this farm festival and purchased, out of his own money, a young calf. And now he loved this calf. The calf was his pet. He actually took really good care of the calf and loved it. He was just obsessed with this calf. And then his parents killed the calf. So what's that going to do to an 11-year-old's mind, you know? He would often try and run away and hide from his parents and stuff like that. So what he would do is he would cut open a pig, gut the pig from inside out, take out all its insides, and then hide inside the pig's corpse. First red flag there straight away. I mean, if you're 11 years old or 12 years old or whatever, and you're hiding inside a dead pig, you're going to grow up to have some issues. Like, they should have taken that kid to a counselor or something, you know, I don't know. I'm no expert, by the way. I'm just sharing my thoughts. His brother, when he was 16 years old, his scumbag brother David, I have one too. when his brother David was 16 years old, he was just learning to drive. He wasn't a confident driver, but he took his mum's car out onto the road and was burning around thinking he was all that. And he actually hit a 14-year-old. So he panicked, didn't know what to do. So he just drove on back home, kind of like a hit and run. Told his mum, I hit some kid, what am I going to do? His mum drove down to the scene, saw the kid dying on the side of the road, and instead of phoning an ambulance, she basically finished him off. I think she beat him over the head and rolled him into like a little stream on the side of the road. So he was already dying, but he just drowned in the stream. She gave him no chance at all. The death was ruled an accident and there was no conviction. And later down the line, the brother would go on to kind of brag about it locally to people, like, he basically got away with murder, ha ha ha. And this just taught Robbie that you can get away with murder, you know, basically. And I suppose the mother doing that just shows that how little they valued human life, you know. Just a quick note on his brother David. He did go on to become a bit of a scumbag too, by the way. He's not as bad as Robert, like, he's not out murdering prostitutes and stuff, but he's not far off. He's a known rapist in Vancouver, and he was heavily involved in the Hells Angels bikers, and Yeah. Nice guy. His sister Linda got out of there at 12 years old. Fair play to her. And apparently she's like a very normal human being to this day. But the parents treated Linda very differently to the brothers. Like, she didn't have to do any work on the farm. They would often buy her fresh clothes, and she actually bathed and stuff like that. They felt like the farm was no place for a girl, so she up and left to go live with relatives at 12 years old and basically escaped misery. Back to Robert, he was a terrible student, a slow learner with a speech impediment. In contrast to that, he was very good on the farm, a hard worker with a talent for dissecting pigs and other farm animals. At age 14, he dropped out of school and he went full time on the farm. I suppose he was kind of afraid of going out into the real world out of fear of failure. Like, dissecting animals and working on the farm was kind of all he knew. It was comfortable for him, and so that's what he did for years, you know. Dropped out of school at 14, and he did some apprenticeship for a little while afterwards, but he quickly dropped out of that for God knows why, and just decided, yeah, I'm gonna stick with the farm, and really leaned into the farm life. Don't think he was really good at anything else, to be honest, so why not? In the late 70s, I think Robert was kind of in his late 20s at the time, both of his parents died. In like the space of a year, both of them died. And when that happened, Robert, of course, inherited the farm, but he began to neglect his duties and his farming obligations. Bill Hiscox, funny name for you, Bill Hiscox, Mr. Hiscox. He used to work around the farm doing a few odd jobs here and there, and he described the farm as being a creepy looking place. He described Willie as a quiet guy who was subject to occasionally very bizarre behavior, which they thought was strange because there was no substance abuse. He wasn't an alcoholic, didn't do drugs, didn't even smoke cigarettes. He just was a weird guy from the inside, you know? But yeah, they left the farm just go to shit. He was a not a hoarder, but like just did no tidying up, like the terrible personal hygiene, no cleaning done whatsoever, didn't care about the mess, you know, he just let it go. He smelled terrible apparently, and never changed, you know, he was always a dirt bag. But at this point of the story, you'd almost feel sorry for the guy, you know, bullied at school, shitty parents, parents just died, smells like a pig's ass. Any sympathy you might be feeling for Willie at this early stage, well, that's about to quickly change. But it does make me wonder, you know, this debate about nature versus nurture. Like, is human behavior determined by a person's environment or by a person's genes? Like, is it hereditary? I think a childhood like Willie's is gonna mess up any child's head, and it's gonna make you a fucked up adult too, you know? But that gives you no excuse for the foul things that Willie did later in life. So, moving the story along a bit, Willie is now coming into his 30s. His parents just died, and the siblings, well, they split the inheritance. His brother and sister wanted nothing to do with the farm, so the farm was all Willie's. Part of his farm duties was taking these trips down to a rendering plant in the downtown east side. I used to be down there with Lee every day, and we would see this same truck drive past every day, full of chickens, and they'd be making so much noise when they're stopped at the traffic light, all the chickens in the back of this lorry, like pop 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 pop. And then the truck would come back like 2 hours later and silence, no chickens in the back, and we're like, Lee used to be like, "Oh, poor chickens." Yeah, it's tough life out there for a farm animal, you know. But this rendering plant is in the downtown east side, and Willie used to make these trips out there, And, you know, he'd get a pint while he's there too. Sure, why not? We get a fucking pint, like. He'd go down there, he'd get a pint, and, you know, he had access to companionship. Men spoke to him as equals down there. He had access to sex. Things that he just couldn't get anywhere else, you know. He was a millionaire farmer. Just inherited his mother's farm. He was in the most impoverished area in Canada, so I suppose this kind of gave him power that he never had before. He would meet women, and the girls that he met would brag about him and how generous he was to them. He gave them food, he gave them money, he bought them drugs. He provided them with whatever they needed. So by now he's getting brazzers with increasing regularity in his pickup truck. They would describe him as odd, but mostly friendly and even a caring guy. He would spend his days butchering pigs on the farm, and he would spend his nights out in the prowl of the east side, looking for some form of companionship. And he'd get it. You know, people living in poverty down there were so desperate for money, and Picton had plenty of it. They say he smelt horrendous.
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
No, Siri, I can't try again. I'm not talking to you.
Okay.
They say he smelt horrendous. But he was very generous with his money, so it didn't matter. For people like Picton, having all of this power was just not enough for him. He needed more and more and more. And in 1980, he picked up a 14-year-old sex worker in the downtown east side, threatened her with a knife, beat her up, raped her, and dumped her out on the side of the road like a piece of rubbish. And he got away with it, so he kept doing it. And later on, he would decide to take it a step further. To him, these prostitutes' lives were no more valuable to the pigs' lives that he slaughtered on a daily basis. Now, nobody can say with any certainty, but they reckon that he committed his first murder around 1983. It was a process that he really enjoyed and actually became addicted to. So, as you can see, he started raping women around 1980, and then he started murdering them in 1983. So, huge jump there in the space of 3 years. He knew it was wrong, but he just couldn't stop. He just kept going for years. Like, even the drive from his farm out to the downtown east side is a good half hour, maybe 40-minute drive. So he had all that time to think about what he was doing, stop the car, turn around, and go home. But he never did. He just had to pick up a girl. And the cycle was literally like, drive out there, find a vulnerable girl, negotiate a price, establish some kind of trust, drive the girl back to his farm, have sex, do drugs, and then attack. He would handcuff them to his bed, and he'd inject them with windshield washer, and they'd be out cold within 10 minutes. And then he'd do whatever he wanted with their lifeless body. He used all kinds of methods to kill his victims. I suppose he just wanted to kind of try all methods, like he shot some, he stabbed some, and strangled some of them. To be honest though, it didn't really matter how they were killed because the outcome was always the same. Their corpse was taken out to the slaughterhouse and butchered just like his pigs. Literally, he'd butcher them with the same knife that he used on his pigs. He would chop up a body, feed most of it to the pigs, and he'd put the leftovers into these big barrels, and he'd bring the barrels down to the rendering plant for disposal. And he got away with this for years. It's a well-known fact that he would grind up human flesh, and he'd actually mix it in with the pig meat or the pork, and it would be sold to the public for consumption. One of his victims' parents they used to actually buy their meat from his farm. So it's very likely that they ate their own daughter unbeknownst to them. Like, how sick is that? He would often sell off chunks of the land and get huge sums of cash. But in 1994, he sold the north end of the farm for a whopping $2 million Canadian. So him and his brother came together and they're like, okay, what are we going to do with our newfound fortune? And they decided to make a quote-unquote charity called the Piggy Palace Good Times Society, where they would basically host these parties and the money raised from the party would go towards a charity of their choice or something along those lines. But basically it was just an excuse for them to have a big party every few weeks. And the parties took place on the farm. They were apparently wild parties, mostly ran by the Hells Angels bikers, who Willie's brother David was heavily affiliated with them. So they would supply the drugs, they would get lots of homeless people, drug addicts and prostitutes from East Hastings to come up to the parties. And yeah, these were crazy, apparently, and the neighbours weren't happy with it at all. Sometimes they would have almost up to 2,000 people at each party, so big numbers there. And this gave Willie access to so many more vulnerable women, you know. They would basically bring herds of these down and out women up to these parties and they'd say, oh, there's going to be loads of drugs, you're going to have somewhere to sleep for the night, we'll get you some food. It's like perfect if you're homeless, you know, you're definitely going to come along. And it was like, take your pick, Willie, you know what I mean? So, excuse me, my voice is really, really letting me down. It's worth mentioning that he did have female friends that he didn't kill. There's one woman that used to go into homeless shelters in the downtown east side and walk around there and try and find young women. And she'd say to them like, oh, come with me back to my friend's farm. We'll give you food, drink, he'll buy you drugs. You know, come with me. She'd make friends with all these girls and build some trust and bring them back to the farm knowing what Willie was going to do to them. So she should be thrown in the slammer too, but I don't think she ever was. There's another friend of Willie's that he just had a soft spot for. I don't think she actually knew what he was up to. I think she knew he was a weirdo, but I didn't think she knew he was as gruesome as he actually was. And she woke up in his trailer one night at like 3 o'clock in the morning, opened the blinds, looked out the window, saw that the lights were on out in the slaughterhouse, and she's like, who the fuck's out there at 3 a.m? So she walked out there, opened the door, and what she saw is a life-changing image. She saw a woman hanging from a hook right next to her, and her feet were at the same level as her eyes. So what she saw was beautiful pink painted toenails, and she looked up, and the flesh was peeled off the top half of her body. And she screamed and ran, and Willie caught her and said, if you tell anyone about this, you'll be right up there on the hook with her, you bitch. So, of course, she kept what she saw to herself for years. And then later, when Willie was arrested, she bravely came forward and testified in court. And no doubt this contributed to Willie being put away. So he was having a great time during these few years, but fast forward to 1997, he picked up an indigenous woman in the downtown east side called Wendy Aisteda and brought her back to his farm, and they were having sex, and during sex he attempted to handcuff her, but she broke free and she ran. He came after her with a knife. And she ran into the kitchen and grabbed one of her own. He stabbed her, she stabbed him. Both of them got injured fairly badly. But lucky for her, he was actually knocked unconscious. I think she got him in the head with the knife, but didn't kill him or anything, you know. He was just knocked unconscious. And she ran out of the trailer, legged it, naked, bloody. She had a punctured lung. She was stabbed multiple times. And she came across an elderly couple who picked her up and took her into the hospital. And funny enough, Willie, well, it's not funny, but you know what I mean. Coincidentally, I should say, Willie later shows up at the exact same hospital for his stab wounds. And the woman's in hospital, laying in bed. Obviously, she told the story to the doctors and nurses or whoever was taking care of her. And she still had this handcuff stuck on her wrist that Willie had put on her. And she told the hospital staff that this guy had put a handcuff on her. He stabbed her multiple times and she stabbed him back in the head. And this guy comes in with a stab wound to the head. So they took his clothes off him, put him in hospital on a different room, I suppose. But they checked his pockets and they found the key for the woman's handcuff. So they put two and two together and they're like, this is our guy. So they reported it to the police. And he was tried for attempted murder. The police took his boots, they took his clothes that he was wearing, and they locked it in a storage room in their headquarters. He was arrested and he managed to convince the police that, that girl Wendy, she's a drug addict, she's very unstable, she doesn't know what she's talking about, blah, blah, blah. Even though she was cut up, you know, and he was cut up, it's like, how is he managing to manipulate his way out of this situation? But the police thought he was a reputable farmer with money and that this woman was just out of her mind. And they were like, you know what, we're going to let you go. So they let him walk free. His day in court comes and Wendy doesn't show up. I suppose she was just absolutely terrified, wanted nothing to do with the whole situation, so she just stayed completely away. And he got off scot-free because nobody was there to testify against him. So it was like, you're free to go. Now, this was a huge misstep from the police in Canada. I'm not sure if it was the RCMP or the VPD, but huge misstep by them, because they let him go in 1998 and then he racked up some numbers after he got away with this. He got very arrogant, you know. Felt like he was unstoppable. He literally got tried for murder, got away with it, so he kept on going. Funny enough, those boots and the clothes that they took off him when they arrested him were in a storage locker in the police headquarters, with DNA from loads of missing women, and they were never checked until like 2004. Lazy police work. No time for that. The same year, 1998, they ignored legal pressure from the government and they held a New Year's Eve party with their Piggy Palace Good Time Society. But after the party, they were faced with an injunction banning all future parties for inability to produce financial statements. It was basically like a money laundering thing for the Hells Angels gangs. They just put all their money into these parties and it was like they were kind of exploiting some legal loophole and cleaning their money through these events. But it was all shut down in 1998, and like I said, the next 3 years, man did some numbers. Fella that worked on his farm, I mentioned him a while ago, Billy Hiscox. He knew that women were going missing in the downtown east side, and it was well known. I should highlight this. It's well known that in the downtown east side, people suspected that there was a serial killer because there were so many women going missing. You know, people would walk in groups and they were taking a lot more caution. There was rumors and, you know, but police never did anything about it. From their point of view, they wanted drug users and sex workers off the streets. So whoever this serial killer was almost doing them a favor, you know. They thought that these women were down and out drug users and they were choosing to live a high risk life. So they didn't deserve a full investigation, you know. Which is terrible, you know. It doesn't matter if you're a sex worker or a drug addict. Nobody deserves to be slaughtered the way they were, you know what I mean. But back to Hiscox. Bill Hiscox, he knew that these women were going missing. He would meet these women on the farm and then later see their face on a missing person poster. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist to put two and two together there. He rang the police on multiple occasions saying, "You have to check out this guy Picton. He's a weirdo. He has women at the farm all the time. They're going missing. Check him out." In 1999, the police received a call saying that Picton actually has human remains in a refrigerator on his farm, and the police didn't believe in it. And they had a warrant to go and search the farm, but they just never followed up on it. Like, what? I know, it's hard to believe, but if you don't believe me, do your research yourself. This is all facts. Time rolls on a bit. Women keep on going missing. There's word on the street of a serial killer. And eventually someone else working on the farm called in that Picton had illegal firearms. So police actually did execute a search warrant on the farm. This was February 6th, 2002. Like I said, they received a tip about illegal weapons, guns. Both brothers were arrested and later released, but Robert was kept under surveillance. I think they were kind of onto him at this stage. Surely when people are actually calling him up, telling him blatantly, like, he is a killer, you know, look into this guy. So you'd hope that they're onto him, you know. But they're on the farm, the place is a shithole, and they're looking for illegal weapons. So I suppose they did have to search the place high and low. And while they were there, they actually found an inhaler. And it was... and it actually had the name of a missing woman in Vancouver on the inhaler. So they were like, hold up, wait a minute. They just found a missing piece of the puzzle. So they rearrested Picton, took him in on two counts of murder, and then they began a huge excavation project of the farm, meeting the place apart looking for more evidence. For the next few weeks, they found human remains, they found body parts from 27 different women, they found a mattress soaked in blood. DNA everywhere. They would find random bones. They found one woman's jawbone buried. Wallets, purses, IDs, bits of clothing. They found two of those barrels that he used to take to the rendering plants. There was a head in each barrel, a woman's head in each barrel, along with their hands and their feet. It's a very odd discovery, you know. He would chop off a woman's head. He would chop off their hands and chop off their feet and put them all in a barrel. And I remember earlier I said it was a fact that Picton was grinding up human flesh and mixing it in with the pork. Like, the government literally revealed in 2004 that they had proof that he was actually doing that. And there was a big investigation with the health and safety and blah, blah, blah. They were able to prove that he was feeding these women directly to his pigs. Like, it does not get worse than that. There should be a movie made about him. I think there might be a movie. Not exactly sure, but I know there's lots of documentaries about it. And I've watched them, obviously, doing the research for this whole case. And you just see, I see places that I used to walk by, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, like this one really hits home, like. But he actually went on to plead not guilty. Imagine, how could you literally be caught for this and plead not guilty? Like, it's insane. So they had him in jail, questioned him, and he pleaded not guilty. He was saying, no, he's been set up and blah, blah, blah. Even though an overwhelming amount of evidence was mounted against him. He blamed it on the Hell's Angels gang, who I've mentioned quite a few times in this case. His attitude was, oh, it was all them and I'm being set up and poor me, this, that and the third. So they actually put an undercover cop in his cell with him and got on his level and talked to him as if they were buddies. And that's when Picton revealed all. He bragged to what he thought was his cellmate about, and they have this all on camera and audio too. It's actually on YouTube. You can listen to him talking about it. Talking about it as if it's a sport. You know what I mean? He's like, Yeah, I killed 49 women. I really wanted to make it an even 50, you know. He's like, I kill more people than the killers in the States. And, you know, he's referencing the Chainsaw Massacre, Ted Bundy, all these famous guys in the United States. He's like, I'm better than those guys. I kill more. And then the cellmate's like, all right, yeah, how did you do it? Like, you know, and he's getting all this information from him very cleverly. And he's like, how did you dispose of them? I suppose the best way to make a body disappear is throw them in the ocean or something like that. And he's like, Picton sitting there, and he's like, nah, I got one better for you. I take their body to a rendering plant and grind it up. And, you know, he's bragging about how he killed these women and how many he killed them. And, oh, it's just sick. So he confessed everything on tape. And he, like he said, the main thing there is, I killed 49 women. I really wanted to make it an even 50. And at that time, the missing person list in the downtown east side was about 65 women. So they had literally just discovered that he was responsible for a huge amount of people on their missing person list. 49 out of 65 people. And then he's like, oh, you know, I got sloppy towards the end. I wasn't covering my tracks as well as I used to and blah, blah, blah. And that's how they caught me and all this. So he confesses everything. And then the case goes to trial. And oddly enough, he's found not guilty on first degree murder. So like, what? He is found guilty on 6 counts of second degree murder. Which means basically that it wasn't premeditated. Like, he killed these people in the heat of the moment. It wasn't like he pre-planned it. But that's outrageous, you know. He used to drive literally half an hour to and half an hour from the downtown east side where he was thinking about what he was doing. It's the most premeditated murder you could ever find. And they were like, nah, we think that he just killed them in the heat of the moment. But Canadian justice system, you know, it's a big circus. Way he got 25 years in jail, and he's like in his 60s at this stage. So he's going to die in jail, you know, 100%. He won't get out. But just to add insult to injury for the victims' families, he actually wrote a book in jail and managed to get the book published. He like smuggled papers out of the jail, and somebody put a book together for him and actually published the book. And it's basically just him saying exactly what I said earlier, poor me, playing the victim, saying that it's a police conspiracy against Picton and the Hells Angels gang, and they're all involved. And he doesn't confess anything in the book, like, it's just all nonsense, the book, really. But it did quite well, and the victim's family feel like he was actually taunting them in a weird, sadistic way. So after so much outrage and upset by people, the book was actually taken off the market, and can't buy it no more. That book can't be got. And rightly so, you know. Pretty incredible that he didn't get the death penalty, to be honest, because I don't know, I think that's exactly what he deserves for what he did, for killing so many young women and destroying so many families. That's really all I have to say about the Picton pig farmer. I strongly urge you to watch some documentary yourself on YouTube. Type in the Picton. I really feel sick talking about this, so I'm glad that is finished, and I am out. Story definitely that needs to be told, because so many people have no idea about this Picton pig farmer guy. And one of the scariest parts about it is, like, this happened in our lifetime. Like, he was only arrested in 2002. So when I was a child, he was out there killing whores, you know what I mean? Like, most killers that I've studied in the past are, like, from way before I was even born. But this is, like, my lifetime, you know. And it was in a place where I actually spent so much of my time. So, as of today, Robert Picton is 70 years old and serving a life sentence in a Quebec prison. And I do hope he feels the sharp end of a knife the same way his 49 victims did. And their lives were taken. That will be the only way justice is served from my point of view.